It is Tuesday, March 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up is support for U.S. President, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump eroding. We'll have a discussion. The White House releases data on its controversial, or will release data on its controversial drone program. And a prominent football star says goodbye to his storied career. It's all ahead. U.S. voters are casting ballots in four states today as new political surveys indicate support for Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump is eroding. I'm joined now by VOA's Catherine Gibson, who's closely following these political developments. Well, Catherine, why is support for Trump seen as declining, or is it?
Well, some national polls are showing that he is declining in support, and that may be due to some of the pushback from the GOP establishment that we've seen in the past few days. The speech that Mitt Romney gave, expressing concerns about his readiness to be president, and then some other GOP establishment figures coming out and saying, you know, do we really want this man to be our nominee? And so there's some speculation that that may be having some impact on voters.
Yes, there's certainly been a lot of controversy, particularly in these debates lately, which have been some people have seen as vulgar, frankly.
That's certainly true.
Well, now, there have been apparently some calls for Florida Senator Marco Rubio to leave the race. Has he made any response about this?
Well, I think Marco Rubio is waiting until his home state of Florida votes next week on the 15th. You know, there's absolutely no chance that he'll get out before that time. He wants to see how he'll do there and then make a decision about whether or not he's getting out of the race. Now, right now, the polls are showing that Donald Trump is leading him in Florida going into that vote. So it remains to be seen whether he'll do well there or not.
But I believe Rubio has tightened a bit in the last few days, I think.
He has. Yes, yeah. That's right. But Donald Trump is still showing a lead there.
Okay. Now, which states are voting today?
So we have Mississippi and we have Michigan. And then we also have primaries in Idaho and a caucus in Hawaii. The main big vote states is Michigan. Michigan has 59 delegates for the Republicans, and that'll be, you know, it's not as big a vote as next week's vote, but it is important in terms of the delegate numbers.
And at the moment, which candidates are leading, and Republicans and Democrats in Michigan?
Hillary Clinton is leading Bernie Sanders in Michigan by a wide margin, and then Donald Trump is showing a lead in Michigan on the Republican side.
Okay, and well, that's also interesting because you also have a Governor John Kasich who is seen as further down, you know, as far as support. However, he is the governor of neighboring states.
Yep, so, we are in his neighborhood,
and
that's
I believe
right.
He has been campaigning quite a bit there.
Oh, he has, absolutely. So it'll be interesting to see how he does tonight.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Catherine. That is Catherine Gibson. I am joined now in the studio by social media editor Andrew Palshevsky, and he's going to be telling me about what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the primary is all the talk of social media here in the U.S., of course, talking about those big states, Michigan included, predicted to be big wins for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So a lot of their supporters are taking to social media kind of preemptively saying, well, it looks like we're going to do well. This is another step in our path towards the nomination. Certainly for Trump supporters saying he's got this locked up. Michigan is another point in this race where he's going to win. He's going to do very well. And people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and John Kasich need to drop out. Ted Cruz is and his supporters on social media are urging Marco Rubio to drop out because they want a one-on-one, you know, mano-a-mano with Donald Trump. And then Marco Rubio, as we talked about, is hanging on to waiting for Florida. So a lot of his supporters talking about that, saying it's not over yet. We still have our home state. And so they're trying to keep spirits up on social media, even in the face of what looks like to be a loss for him tonight.
Mm-hmm. Anything else trending, or is it all politics?
Not all politics. It's actually the biggest trending topic right now is International Women's Day. So we have several trending hashtags, hashtag International Women's Day, hashtag IWD2016, and then there are some interesting ones that focus on more specific topics. Hashtag Pledge for Parity, which is actually the topic of this year's International Women's Day, pledging for parity in the workplace, parity on a whole number of levels for women. Hashtag Planet 50/50 as well, which the goal is by 2030 to have a planet that is 50-50 men and women in terms of equality, in terms of pay, in terms of a number of issues. So this is actually something we're going to be covering on our show, #VOA, in probably about 15, 20 minutes from now. So people can tune into that, voanews.com/#VOA, a huge social media story today that everyone's talking about around the world.
Absolutely. So be sure you watch. Thanks very much, Andrew. That is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Well, the White House will be releasing data on drone strikes, and I'm joined by VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, this has been a controversial program. What is known, what will be released as far as the casualties, from these strikes?
What we're being told by the White House is that they're going to release in the coming weeks numbers on casualties, exactly that, how many people were killed, and to the extent that they know, how many were civilians and how many were classified as terrorists or enemy combatants. They say that they're doing this for a couple of reasons. First, it's part of President Obama's commitment to transparency, although critics will contend if that was the case, it could have been done quite some time ago. And the White House spokesman Josh Earnest yesterday also made a point saying that the terrorists, groups like Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, others, have been telling their own narrative, saying that claiming that the U.S. is using these strikes for other means, that civilians are being killed. And the U.S. across the board, the administration, military officials have long said that they've gone out of their way, no matter what the strike, to avoid civilian casualties. And in fact, there's been some criticism from within the intelligence and military community that the U.S. has been too careful in trying to avoid civilian casualties. But the White House is contending that by releasing this data, it will show that the U.S. truly does just target the enemy combatants and that it does try to avoid innocent deaths.
Because it must be, in some situations, very difficult to determine whether there are civilians in certain sites as opposed to just fighters.
And that's one of the debates that goes into all the strikes about having not just intelligence from the air, not just surveillance from the air, but also intelligence on the ground, whether, and this comes into play in Iraq and in Syria, where the U.S. now has special operation forces, the need for teams on the ground to identify targets and relay that information to commanders who are calling in the airstrikes.
Have drone strikes been expanded under the Obama administration?
Airstrikes have been used quite a bit by the Obama administration in the war on terror in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, but also in places like Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. But one of the things that analysts are looking to get from these numbers is more information on who was hit, at least according to the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, to figure out how effective these strikes are. Right now, there have been some organizations that keep tabs on the strikes, but it's mostly compilations from what's being reported by media outlets, whether in country or by big organizations like the wire services, Reuters, VOA, others. And one of them, Long War Journal, has found that since 2006 in Pakistan, there have been a total of 389 drone strikes that have killed, according to media reports and other sources, almost 2,800 extremist leaders or operatives and only 158 civilians. In Yemen, since 2002, Long War Journal has found that there have been 135 strikes, killing an estimated 657 combatants and only 105 civilians. But what they want to find out is to dig a little deeper and to find out how were those strikes carried out? What level of leadership was present? Were there fighters? Was it mid-level leadership or was it high-level leadership? Because then they can go back and look at the other information that's known and figure out how effective have the strikes really been in deterring terrorist organizations. There's been some evidence, some studies that show that the decapitation strikes or airstrikes, drone strikes that take out leaders of terrorist groups have not been all that successful in the sense that those groups become more hardened, that they are still resilient, and that they find ways to replace those leaders. There are plenty of factors of why that could be, but the additional information could help narrow them down. And in turn, it might also help U.S. policymakers determine how to go forward.
All right. Thanks very much. That's VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Well, the Pentagon says a U.S. airstrike on al-Shabaab in Somalia last weekend killed 150 militants. I'm joined now by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what is the Pentagon saying about the significance of the strike?
Well, the Pentagon is saying that this was a very significant strike. They said that this is a large number of targeted fighters that were killed. The initial estimates are that 150 fighters were killed. I know that local commanders on the ground had said initial reporting that at least 70 fighters were killed, with dozens more wounded, and the death toll could rise into well over 100. So we still don't know exactly how many were targeted, but the fact that there were that many together at one time is incredibly significant for the Pentagon.
This occurred apparently at a training camp. What is known about this camp?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because al-Shabaab has come out and said, well, we don't generally put a lot of people together at one time, so this couldn't have been true. But what we're hearing from locals on the ground, VOA had heard that this was a graduation for these trainees. These trainees had come together to do some sort of large-scale attack on the African Union forces, to which the United States has people embedded, helping as training, helping with being liaisons for this group. So very important for the United States. And so it appears that they were outside, these trainers, according to a U.S. official, said that they were outside in one pretty large area. So without giving up intelligence and telling you exactly what was going on, it sounds like the locals could be right and that it was a graduation ceremony.
Well, and it shows that the intelligence that went into this was very significant.
Absolutely. The Pentagon had been following this training session for several weeks, it said, and it appeared that the trainees were about to leave, which could make sense with the graduation ceremony, and they decided to strike, and locals had said that they came in twice using manned and unmanned aircraft. They came in with two swoops, about three missiles each time, and eliminated as many of the threat as they could.
Well, thanks. My thanks to Carla Babb at the Pentagon. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
French scientists have found that the surface of Mars tilted between 20 and 25 degrees over 3 billion years ago. And the culprit behind its cause is a massive volcanic structure. The scientists say that enormous amounts of lava that pumped out of the volcanoes on Mars, the largest in the solar system, over the course of several hundred million years, formed a huge volcanic dome in the Tharsis region of the Red Planet. In a paper published by the journal Nature, the research team, which included geomorphologists, geophysicists, and climatologists, suggests that because it's so incredibly enormous, the dome caused the crust and mantle of Mars to rotate around its core. It's thought that the Tharsis volcanic dome started to form at a Martian latitude of about 20 degrees north over 3.7 billion years ago. The researchers said the eventual surface shift may explain why it now sits on the Red Planet's equator. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, football star Peyton Manning announces his retirement. To the day after Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared after takeoff from Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing with 239 passengers and crew. Investigators are no closer to solving one of the great mysteries of aviation history. The Boeing 777 disappeared from radar screens March 8, 2014. At least one wing fragment located on Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean is the only firm link to the fate of the aircraft. Two other pieces of debris located on Reunion and the beach of Mozambique are to be examined. Kok Suk Chun is lead investigator of an international team that includes officials from Malaysia, the United States, China, Australia, Britain, and France.
At this time, the team is continuing to work towards finalizing its analysis, findings, conclusions, and safety recommendations on 8 relevant areas associated with the disappearance of MH370 based on available information. A final report will be completed in the event wreckage of the aircraft is located or the search for the wreckage is terminated, whichever is the earlier.
Todd Curtis heads AirSafe, a U.S. group that provides air safety information to the traveling public. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty where the investigation stands now.
What is known is that the airplane went off course for reasons that haven't been quite determined, and that indirect evidence indicates that the aircraft was flying at a stable altitude and direction for several hours before apparently running out of fuel over the middle of the ocean. And that, unfortunately, is where it stood since then. In spite of the recovery of a flapper on a piece of the trailing edge of the wing last July in Reunion Island, it more or less confirms that somehow or another, the aircraft, or at least that part of the aircraft, ended up in the ocean. But exactly why is still a bit of a mystery.
Well, where does the investigation centering right now, where is its focus?
The focus is on a very specific patch of the southern Indian Ocean, an area of the ocean where it was determined through indirect means, specifically signals received by an Inmarsat satellite, where through some extraordinary mathematical work, they were able to determine roughly where the aircraft was during the final hours of flight and approximately where the aircraft may have run out of fuel. And the search effort, which consists of a combination of doing basic mapping of the ocean bottom and more specific close-in analysis of certain areas of the ocean bottom, that effort is out there to attempt to find some part of the aircraft and hopefully to recover large parts of the aircraft for analysis.
Now, Australian, Malaysian, and Chinese authorities plan to end this search later this year. Do you think there will be political pressure on them to continue?
Well, certainly there will be political pressure and pressure from the victims' families, as well as pressure from organizations who have a stake in the outcome. Obviously, any operator of the 777 would be interested to see if anything about this event can be tied to the design or the operation of the aircraft, in which case you may have to change either the procedures or the aircraft component itself or aircraft systems itself to make the fleet safe. And also the countries who have been most heavily involved in this, Malaysia, Australia, of course, China, which had the majority of passengers on board, and the U.S., which is the country of manufacture of the aircraft and, of course, has a vested interest in understanding this. They would like to have some sort of closure. What is left as an open question is who is going to provide the funding that can allow that closure to happen.
That's Todd Curtis of AirSafe. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. One of the top National Football League quarterbacks of our time, Peyton Manning, is retiring. Manning, who just led the Denver Broncos to a Super Bowl win, made the announcement Monday after an NFL career lasting 18 seasons. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talks with Michael Lippin about the end of Manning's career.
Peyton Manning, by the way, called the Broncos late Saturday to inform him that he would be retiring. This news conference on Monday had previously been scheduled for the Broncos, but they didn't know what Manning's decision would be, if he would continue to play with the team or if he would indeed retire. They did not know that until he called them. Manning is credited with transforming the overall game into a more pass-oriented contest, and he also brought a sense of dignity and work ethic to the National Football League at a time when there were drug scandals and off-the-field incidents, and they were severely tarnishing the professional game's image. By the way, his little brother Eli came to the field after Manning, and he himself won two Super Bowls for the New York Giants. They are both the sons of former New Orleans Saints quarterback Archie Manning, and so with Peyton, there was a link with the past and also a vision for the future of the game.
And maybe a little sibling rivalry too, huh?
Absolutely, because baby brother got his two rings first before Peyton did.
Right.
Peyton Manning played 18 seasons. 14 of those came with the Indianapolis Colts, 4 with the Denver Broncos. His teams made the playoffs in 15 of his 18 seasons. That's how good he was. He reached the coveted 4,000-yard passing mark in just 14 seasons. the Colts had years before when Manning was just a little kid. He was 8 years old. They moved from Baltimore to Indianapolis. And when Indianapolis inevitably made that first trip back to play the new team that was there, the Ravens, Peyton was able to meet one of his football idols, NFL quarterback legend Johnny Unitas. And Peyton recalled that encounter during his emotional retirement announcement Monday with the media.
I had met him once before, but when the game was over, I had a chance to shake Johnny Unitas' hand. He told me, Peyton, you stay at it. I'm pulling for you. Well, I have stayed at it. I've stayed at it for 18 years. And I hope that old number 19 is up there with his flat top and maybe his black high tops on. And I hope he knows that I have stayed at it, and maybe he's even a little proud of me. There's just something about 18 years. 18 is a good number. And today I retire from pro football.
Well, Manning won two Super Bowls, one each with the Colts and Broncos. He was nicknamed the Sheriff, so this last Super Bowl was his last rodeo, they say. He was the league's most valuable player five times. He collected 200 wins, including playoffs, and, of course, that last one coming in Super Bowl 50. Beyond the numbers and the production of the field, the fact that he helped four head coaches reach the Super Bowl, his legacy will be his ability to put the game back into the hands of the quarterback, make it more of a passing game.
That's Jim Stevenson. He was speaking with Michael Lippin. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 8th is International Women's Day, celebrated by the United Nations since 1975 and adopted by a UN resolution in 1977 as United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. It is a day to reflect on women's progress, call for further change, and acknowledge the courage and determination of women working for gender equality around the world. It is also an opportunity to raise awareness about the struggles of women and girls the world over. Struggles for education, for equality before the law, for access to basic services that men take for granted, such as access to banking or training, and adult education. In too many cases, women struggle for basic respect, and in the worst cases, they struggle to be seen not as the property of anyone, but as a free and independent person. The fact is that although women and girls have made great strides in the past 41 years, they still have a long way to go. Nowhere in the world can women claim to have all the same rights and opportunities as men. The majority of the world's poorest people are women, and their work is less valued. They receive 30 to 40% less pay than men for doing the same work. Their lack of economic power sometimes translates to powerlessness in other aspects of their lives as well, where they disproportionately suffer from gender-based violence. That is why this year's theme is Planet 50-50 by 2030, Step It Up for Gender Equality. A part of the United Nations 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, it is an all-out push to implement a number of United Nations commitments on gender equality, women's empowerment, and women's human rights. This includes goals such as ending all forms of discrimination against women and girls everywhere, eliminating all forms of violence against women and girls, stopping all practices specifically harmful to girls, such as child, early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation, and ensuring that all girls and boys receive a quality primary and secondary education. Any society hoping to flourish must begin by empowering its women and by promoting for them the same rights that men already enjoy. On International Women's Day, we celebrate and honor women and girls and commit ourselves to making the world a place where women and girls are not excluded or marginalized, but are free to realize their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.